I mentioned this yesterday on the program. I was a little surprised when I was doing a bit of family visits and vacationing over the weekend to pick up the Dallas Morning News and to read there in the A section that new research showed that there was no link, and that's exactly what the headline read there in the Dallas Morning News, no link between abortion, breast cancer. Now, we've been doing programs for probably two or maybe better than that, 2 years here on Issues Etc., establishing the link between abortion and breast cancer with the research, and really the preponderance of research. Yet a new study in London says that if you go back over the data, that's not right. There is no link. And the author of the study says we can be really definitive that neither induced abortions nor miscarriages increase breast cancer risk. That's Valerie Barrall. She's the author of the study at the University of Oxford. We're going to be talking about that study and about what the research really does show on the link between abortion and breast cancer here in the first 25 minutes of Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Now, for those of you who weren't listening yesterday, we are back on live. I have returned from Dallas, having seen home my younger brother from his year's stay in Iraq. And so, as yesterday, we're on live today, Thursday, the 1st of April. And it's not an April Fool's joke. We actually are live. We will be having open lines in the latter half of the program, and that's why I want you to note the fact that we are, well, we're live. Thursday, April 1st, 2004. Our call-in numbers for these 3 hours of Issues Etc., 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Karen Malik of the Coalition on Abortion and Breast Cancer will be with us here in the first 25 minutes or so. We'll be also talking a little later in this hour with Wendy Wright of Concerned Women for America on two subjects. First, the legal challenges to the partial birth abortion ban that is working its way legislatively at the federal level. And we'll also be talking about the president's intent to sign the Unborn Victims of Violence Act, not in a small ceremony, but in a rather elaborate ceremony. Wendy Wright will be our guest there. And then, a little bit later, near the end of this first hour, Representative Mark Wright of Springfield, he's a co-sponsor of an amendment that would ban gay marriage in the Missouri House. We'll be talking about actually a constitutional amendment, and it's working its way through the legislature in Missouri. That's the whole first hour of Issues Etc. We have open lines a little bit later in the program. Those of you who are waiting to hear part five of our seven-part series on the liturgy of sickness, dying, and death, and today we were going to talk about the funeral, Pastor Will Whedon, our guest in that series, has other duties he needs to attend to today that came up late in the day, and so we'll be rescheduling him for next week. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Karen Malik is a regular guest here on Issues Etc. She's president of the Coalition on Abortion and Breast Cancer based in Palos Heights, Illinois. Karen, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
So how is it that I can read numerous studies and walk over them with you and others on the link between abortion and breast cancer, and then this weekend read a headline in the Dallas Morning News that says there is no link?
Well, this is the pattern that they have displayed when it comes to this abortion issue. Abortion's a very hot topic, as you know, and there are scientists in our scientific community who have shown a considerable amount of scientific bias against this data, showing an overwhelming link between abortion and breast cancer. And this is just one more effort in a nearly 50-year history of debunking the research and trying to cover it up and conceal it from women. Let's face it, they didn't tell women about the existence of this research going back to 1957 and 1968, when the first two studies were published on Japanese women. They didn't tell us about that when abortion was legalized in 1973, and they didn't want us to know. And they didn't want us to know about it in 1981, when the first study on American women was published, and that showed a 140% risk elevation. This particular study by Valerie Barrall and colleagues is a collaborative reanalysis. What that means is they looked at a bunch of studies, and they picked out some studies and others were excluded. And it's very, very vulnerable because their exclusion criteria are very, very questionable. And you know, I have a real big problem with this because, for instance, there, let me just give you an example here that really is, this is a perfect example of their bias. If the original author of a study could not be found, then they excluded the study. Now, what that means is, if we can't find Copernicus at the University of Krakow, then we should exclude his research, which shows that the Earth revolves around the sun, and not vice versa. Do you see what I'm saying? We can't find Einstein either, and we can't find Galileo. Should we exclude their research? So I just think this research is very, very vulnerable, and it just falls apart on careful scrutiny. What they tried to do here is to say that 28 studies reporting risk elevations should be disregarded because the researchers used interviews of women about their abortion histories. And they say women cannot be trusted. The Valerie Barrel study actually says that women cannot be trusted to actually report or accurately report their abortion histories.
Now, wait a minute here. Let's just take the simplest scenario. Did you or did you not have an abortion?
Right.
Is Valerie Barrel supposing that women who answer yes to that question cannot be trusted any more than a woman who says no? They can't accurately remember whether they had an abortion?
Well, they've actually given two excuses. First of all, they've hypothesized, they've actually argued that women over-report their abortions. In other words, they say they've had more abortions than what they've really had, and that's absurd. And in fact, two teams of scientists actually criticized that quite harshly, and the original authors who put forward that particular theory withdrew that claim. They were saying that there were more patients who were accusing themselves of having had abortions that they never really had. More patients did that than healthy women.
Well, now, I can understand, although I don't agree, I agree with you here, Karen, but I can understand how a woman might say, if she's had two, she might say she had three. But for a woman who's had no abortion to say she's had one seems somewhat absurd.
Oh, absolutely. So they backed away from that claim of over-reporting, and then they changed their hypothesis to another one called under-reporting. This time they said that there are more healthy women who under-report their abortions. More healthy women do that than sick women. That's why we're seeing this imbalance with so many women who are sick who are reporting abortion histories, and they're saying that's why the research, they're arguing the research is all false, that the findings are false because the women are not accurately reporting the number of abortions they've had.
Did Valerie Barrel and the other authors of this Oxford study, and by the way, it is published today in the Lancet Medical Journal, did they actually do any real research themselves beyond just reevaluating old research and discounting old research?
No, this was a review of old research. So they looked at the research that had been published over a long period of time, over a half century here nearly. And so they were pooling, they were looking at the data. This was a collaboration among authors to look at their data and reanalyze their data. But going back to the argument that they were putting forward about underreporting, what Valerie Barrel and her colleagues are really saying here is that women agree to join these studies examining a link between abortion and breast cancer, but then they decide to lie because they don't want to talk about their abortions. But there's an even better theory that's available, and that is, doesn't it make sense to say that women who don't want to talk about their abortion histories are not going to join an abortion breast cancer study. They're going to refuse to join an abortion breast cancer study to begin with. They're not going to decide to join and then lie. They're going to say, no, I just don't want to go there. I don't want to talk about it. And that's that. I'm not going to be a subject in this study.
I'm just thinking, if I'm a cigarette manufacturer and I want to discount the link between, say, smoking cigarettes and lung cancer.
Right.
I can, if I want to, go back over all the research that's shown a link between smoking cigarettes and lung cancer, and that have compared people who smoke and their rates of lung cancer with people who don't smoke and their rates of lung cancer. And I can say, as does Valerie Beryl here in this research, it appears, well, those who report no smoking, say they don't smoke, they're just lying. They actually
right.
smoke and they're healthy. Therefore, that proves there's no real link between the two because smokers and non-smokers contract the disease at the same rate.
That's correct. That's correct. And I like your smoking analysis because there are a great many parallels that can be made here to the tobacco industry. The abortion industry is big business. It's a huge business. And let's face it, the wealthiest men in the world are pouring billions and billions of dollars into population control. And governments are pouring their billions into population control. They have to have abortion in order to have any successful population control programs. Once abortion is gone, then women have contraceptives to use, but when their contraceptives fail, they don't have abortion to resort to. So that's why they have to have abortion in there, included in their population control programs, to make them really conspicuously successful programs. And it's big business. There's lots of money that's involved here. You know, I'd like to just mention here also, there's an article that was published in the LA Times. It's an op-ed article that was published on August 31st, 2003, and it's written by Dr. Samuel Epstein, who is a professor of public health at the University of Illinois, and also Dr. Quentin Young. He's chairman of the Health and Medicine Policy Research Group in Chicago, and he's former president of the American Public Health Association. They make some very, very serious charges here in their article about, or rather against, the cancer establishment. And it says, they both say here, the more money that you throw at the cancer establishment, the greater the mortality rate. In the last 33 years since President Nixon declared his war on cancer in 1971, we have poured all kinds of money into cancer, into the cancer establishment here. Now, just in the case of the NCI's budget, the National Cancer Institute's budget, it shot up from $150 million in 1970 to $4.6 billion. And in that time, the cancer mortality rate, the cancer death rate, increased by 30 percentage points. So they support their argument here that this is really a black hole here. It's been a black hole for the last 33 years, and the cancer establishment traditionally has not shown any interest in cancer prevention, and there's much that can be done in the way of cancer prevention. Now, these two authors also charge that the cancer establishment has not only failed in its efforts to embrace the mission that it was charged with, but also they have suppressed evidence of causation that it had in its possession. And they were talking about exposure, environmental exposure to carcinogens, and also occupational exposure to carcinogens. Now, when we talk about breast cancer, there's much that can be done in the way of prevention. And women really aren't being told about it. In fact, the scientists are saying in their research that the cancer rates could be cut by one half if only women start having their first full-term pregnancies at an earlier age. And by early, that means before age 24. If we could change our childbearing patterns, this would do a great deal of good for women in reducing the breast cancer rates. And the reason is because childbearing is the only mechanism, it's the only event in a woman's life that matures her breast cells into cancer-resistant cells. That's why the scientists say the earlier you have a first full-term pregnancy, the lower the risk. Now, we're not telling teenagers and unmarried women to go out and get pregnant, but we are saying if a teenager is already pregnant, she has a right to know. Her parents have a right to know before they take her to the abortion clinic. This is the most significant means of reducing risk for this serious disease, this fatal disease.
Karen, what is the most important thing that our listener needs to know when they pick up the headline that says, new study rejects view that abortions increase the risk of breast cancer, comes from The Lancet, it comes from a prestigious university, claims to have reevaluated decades of research. What's the most important thing for them to remember about what the research really shows with regard to abortion and breast cancer?
Well, actually, I would say two things about that, if I could. The first thing is that you would not know from the media stories that this meta-analysis actually included an examination of the studies that collected their data by doing interviews with women. And it also included a separate examination of studies that relied on medical records of abortion. So they compared the two. And they still found a significant link among those studies that relied on interviews. They, even after excluding certain studies using very, very questionable, very suspect criteria for excluding those studies. So they still came up with a link, a significant link, and they're not telling women this. I think the problem with the media is they look at the abstract, they look at the conclusions, what is the bottom line in this study, and they're not reading the whole study. And maybe that's because many of the writers aren't capable of analyzing the studies properly. The second thing that I would say is Valerie Barrell, not even 2 years ago, published yet another review in the same medical journal, The Lancet. It received all kinds of press. And that particular review found that women who increase their childbearing can reduce the risk for breast cancer by 7% for every child that a woman bears. And furthermore, for every 12 months that a woman breastfeeds her child, she gains a reduction in her lifetime risk of breast cancer of 4.3%. That's quite significant. And moreover, Valerie Barrell said, she's one of those, by the way, who said, we could cut the breast cancer rates in the developing nations by more than half if only women would have more children and breastfeed their children longer. So it is intellectually dishonest for her now to come out and say abortion's unrelated to breast cancer risk, increased risk of breast cancer.
Karen Malik, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues Etc.
You're welcome.
Karen Malik is president of the Coalition on Breast Cancer, Abortion and Breast Cancer, based in Palos Heights, Illinois. You can check out their website, by the way, at abortionbreastcancer.com. It's all one word, abortionbreastcancer.com.
Anytime an expectant mother is a victim of violence, two lives are in the balance, each deserving protection and each deserving justice.
That was President George W. Bush a little more than an hour ago as he signed into law the Unborn Victims of Violence Act. our guest for the remainder of this part of Issues Etc. over the break, Wendy Wright, Senior Policy Director for Concerned Women for America. Wendy, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you. I'm glad to be on.
Your reaction to the president's general enthusiasm shown here for this bill, the Unborn Victims of Violence Act.
You know, I'm so pleased that he is so eager to sign this into law, and this is something that he has wanted to do, you can tell, for quite a while. And the law has been a long time in coming. It's taken a number of years to get it from the stage of a bill to where it is today, now a law. The holdup was in the Senate of the United States. It passed several times in the House of Representatives, but we just could not get the senators to take it out for a vote. And that mainly was when the Democrats were in control of the Senate. Once the Republicans were in control, it still took us a little while. It's been over a year now. But finally, they were able to get agreement to get it passed unanimously. And that means, I'm sorry, not unanimously, but able to bring it up without any amendments or anything being added to it. There was a bit of a battle in the Senate. Senator Feinstein from California wanted to literally gut the bill and change it into something totally different where it would only recognize a pregnant woman, that it would be a crime, a higher crime, to attack a pregnant woman than it would be to attack anyone else. But the question, logical question that must be asked is, why is a pregnant woman different from any other woman or anyone else? The reason she's different is because she's carrying a child. And if she is harmed, it's not only her that is oftentimes harmed, but that harm can cause the death of a separate human being, the child that she is carrying. So thankfully, that amendment from Senator Feinstein did not pass, but the vote was 50-49. It was very close. And because it didn't pass and it was a clean bill that passed, so now federal law finally recognizes that when a pregnant woman is assaulted and her baby is injured or killed, that is a separate and additional crime to the harm that's done to the woman.
But we have about 2 minutes here, no more, before we go to our first break here, Wendy. Are there any expected challenges to this law now that it has the president's signature?
Well, you know, that's a good question. In Ohio, which had a state bill, they're called fetal homicide bills or unborn victims of violence, there was a case in which a woman was assaulted. The assailant actually stated the reason that she was kicking the woman in her stomach was to cause the baby to die. When she was then brought up on trial, her attorney tried to argue that the law was unconstitutional because it was recognizing an unborn child. And under Roe v. Wade, you're not allowed to recognize an unborn child. Thankfully, he lost and she was convicted.
Wendy Wright is our guest. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about the president's signature and the bill itself, the Unborn Victims of Violence Act, now a law. We'll be talking about that. And a little bit later with Wendy, we'll talk about the legal challenges that are being mounted in the courts to the ban on partial birth abortion at the federal level. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Wendy Wright is Senior Policy Director for Concerned Women for America. The president has put his signature on this bill. That does not necessarily mean that it's out of the woods. We'll talk a little bit more about that when we come back.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
If you're a talk radio junkie like me, you might assume that the programming is free. Commercial advertisers pay for the production costs and staff salaries. Well, that's true for most talk radio shows, but not for Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is listener-supported. That means we rely on you to pay the production salaries and airtime costs for this worldwide outreach. Hi, this is Todd Wilkin asking you to prayerfully consider making a financial gift to Issues Etc. today. You can donate online, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. You can donate by credit card, 1-800-737-0172, or you can donate by check, Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Remember, unlike other talk radio shows, Issues Etc. needs your financial support. We depend upon you for the continuation and expansion of Issues Etc.
Now this Global Minute focuses your attention on praying over the globe. Prayer gives us a strategic foundation for sharing Christ across cultures. That's the view of pastor-teacher John Piper, who challenges us to be willing to do missions, even if it costs us our lives.
And so I pray that you will come on and leave behind the American way of security and ease and comfort and retreat and withdrawal and emptiness. Leave it behind.
Here's one way you and your family can pray for missions. Get a free CD from the Mission Vision Network featuring one-minute prayer requests, which include unreached peoples, along with messages by men like John Piper. Call 1-800-268-0461. 1-800-268-0461. Or log on to missionvisionnetwork.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. In 1564, King Charles IX of France introduced a new calendar. Up until then, the new year had been celebrated from March 21st until April 1st. But Charles' new calendar dictated that January 1st would become New Year's Day. Well, since there's nothing new under the sun, some people did not adjust to the change and kept on celebrating April 1st. They came to be known as April Fools. Pranks soon became part of the day. Hindsight is 20/20. If someone fools you today, you won't realize it until after the fact. And that, I think, is a little ray of insight on spiritual reality. In his parable about the five wise and the five foolish virgins, Jesus makes clear that it's at the end of your life, Judgment Day, that your spiritual wisdom or folly will be revealed. Although a Gallup poll last year showed 2/3 of American adults believe in hell, the poll also revealed that only 1% think that they'll go there. If you are in the 99% that doesn't expect hell, make sure your reasons are right. 1 Corinthians 1:18 says, "The word of the cross is folly to those who are perishing." Thanks for listening, and I'm Dale Meyer.
You see, at just the right time, when we were still powerless, Christ died for the ungodly. Very rarely will anyone die for a righteous man, though for a good man someone may possibly dare to die. But God demonstrates his own love for us in this: while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. For just as through the disobedience of the one man the many were made sinners, so through the obedience of the one man the many will be made righteous. For the wages of sin is death, but the gift of God is eternal life in Christ Jesus our Lord.
In about 15 minutes here on Issues Etc., we're going to be joined by Representative Mark Wright of Springfield, Missouri, to talk about a constitutional amendment passed by the Missouri House yesterday that would ban gay marriage. Representative Mark Wright is co-sponsor of this bill. Right now we're talking with Wendy Wright. She's Senior Policy Director for Concerned Women for America. We're still on the subject of the Unborn Victims of Violence Act. Did I hear you say before the break, Wendy, that this bill has been, if the constitutionality of this bill now law has been tested already, or is it still to be tested at the federal level?
The federal level has not yet been tested because it's only been signed into law a couple of hours, and so that just happened today. However, there have been state laws that are very similar that have been passed, going back to the 1970s. California, where Lacey and Connor Peterson lived, their fetal homicide law has been on the books since before Roe versus Wade. In Ohio, they passed a fetal homicide law just recently, and it was in that state that it was being challenged. And every time that these state laws have been challenged, they have been upheld. There's not been a single time in which a judge has overturned an Unborn Victims of Violence Act.
You said something very telling before, the kind of the legal rubric that is written larger than all others when it comes to these issues is the Roe v. Wade decision. It seems to kind of run the day in the courts whenever any law seems to talk about matters of the womb. Suddenly Roe v. Wade is invoked as the the warden that stays off all challenges.
Yeah, generally, you're right. That's true. And in this case, this will really determine how far Roe v. Wade is going to cover. Because in the case of Roe v. Wade, the court was saying that the woman can decide what to do with her body, and she can decide whether or not to have an abortion, breaking it up into a trimester system, saying that in the last trimester, the state has an interest and an abortion can only be chosen in the case of a woman's life being in danger or her health being in danger. Now, on the same day that Roe versus Wade was handed down, there was a companion case that the Supreme Court decided called Doe versus Bolton. And in Doe versus Bolton, they defined health of the mother as meaning literally anything. Her age, her psychological health, her financial health. And so it's ended up being a door that can be kicked open by any excuse whatsoever. So that is why we're seeing with the partial birth abortion ban, the debate over whether a health of the mother exception ought to be included in the ban. Going back to unborn victims, though, the distinction here is that the woman is not choosing to abort her child. There's a third person, other than the mother and the baby, that's deciding that the baby needs to die. Now, in some cases, there may be an assailant who harms a pregnant woman, causing the death or injury of her baby, and that assailant never knew that she was pregnant. In a case in Minnesota, this happened. And so the defendant's attorney argued, since the assailant didn't know that she was pregnant, then he can't be guilty of this crime. And the judge ruled otherwise and said it doesn't matter if the assailant knows she's pregnant or not. The fact that you are hitting a woman who is of childbearing age, that alone puts you at risk of having caused injury to her child. And so if the child is injured, you face a separate offense.
So how does this bill, now law, how does the law define the second victim in a violent crime?
Well, defines as an unborn baby. In fact, the name of the law is the Unborn Victims of Violence Act. And you do bring up an interesting point, because AP, the premier news source, just simply still refuses to recognize this as a baby, and they continue to say a fetus. And in the news story about this law being signed today, it references some other things that President Bush has done that have been pro-life acts, and refers to a law called the Born Alive Infant Protection Act. This was signed into law over a year ago, and it states that if a baby is born alive, that means a baby that has survived an abortion, that baby is a person and is recognized in the eyes of the law as a person. And the reason this is significant is because there have been abortionists who have been delivering a baby live and then simply leaving that baby to die from neglect. And this was a bill signed into law to protect those babies. Now, AP, in their news story, they refer to these babies that are born alive as fetuses. Well, once a baby's born, it's no longer a fetus. But AP just simply won't recognize the victim of an abortion as being a baby.
Are you confident that this particular law will stand up to constitutional scrutiny?
Yes. I'm very confident. Every state law that's been challenged has stood up, and the Supreme Court would have to do an incredible gymnastics to say that a woman who wants her child, who's been assaulted, that child has no rights whatsoever. Now, we believe that every child is wanted, and maybe not wanted by the mother at that point when she's considering an abortion, but even at any time, there are people who are willing to adopt that child, and even regardless, at all times, that child is wanted by God. God is the one who created that baby in the first place. So we don't like to use that distinction of a wanted baby or an unwanted baby. But let's just say we're discussing this on the terms of the abortion industry, and they claim that a baby that's unwanted doesn't have the right to live. Well, here are cases in which the woman wants the child, and yet that child's being snatched away from her. If this were being done in China, we would call that a forced abortion. And in this case, even in the United States, they should be called forced abortions. And that assailant should not have the right to determine for anyone else that that child doesn't have the right to live.
We would be remiss if we did not outline the limits of this federal law, because it does deal exclusively with federal crimes. Am I correct?
That's correct. Now, what that means is if the crime occurs where there's federal jurisdiction, for example, on a military base or on an interstate highway, in the cases where there is a federal jurisdiction. So, for example, with Lacey and Connor Peterson, there wasn't federal jurisdiction, even though this law is named after that case. But there are other cases. For example, there was a different case in Ohio than the one I mentioned earlier, in which it was occurred on a military base. And in that case, it was only because the state prosecutor was able to find a state concern that they were able to file charges against the husband in that case who caused the death of the unborn child. But there are some cases in which there's only federal jurisdiction, and that's why there needs to be a federal law.
How many states have similar laws that would cover then the non-federal crimes?
Nearly a majority. There are over 30 states that have passed Unborn Victims of Violence Act. So this has been something that's been well recognized. And sadly enough, it's not a rare occurrence. We may not hear about it very often, but there have been numerous cases in which pregnant women have been assaulted and it causes the death or injury of her child. And that's why in the signing ceremony today, there were several families that were present. Some were the mother herself. She didn't die, but her baby died. And in other cases, it was the family of the women, because it was both the woman and her baby who died. So the number one cause of death of pregnant women is homicide. This is not a rare occurrence. And in those cases, it's not only one person who dies, there's two.
How do you evaluate George W. Bush's record up to this point? He's nearing the end of his first term on the issue of pertaining to these things, life issues.
Well, he's done a number of very good things. For example, with the Children's Health Insurance Act, he's extended that to include unborn children, which only makes sense. In order to get a healthy start in life, we have to start prior to the child's birth. And we all know of very serious complications that a person can have for their entire life if they don't have a healthy pregnancy. That's one of the things, the Born Alive Infant Protection Act, which I mentioned earlier, where President Bush signed into law stating that a baby that's born alive is a person and has the same rights that you and I have. He also signed executive orders such as the Mexico City policy, which states that no federal tax dollars will go to international organizations that commit or promote abortion. And there are a number of abortion groups that have just gone apoplectic over this. They call it a gag rule and say that they are limited. Their free speech rights have been hindered. They've been censored, and that they have been closing down clinics all around the world because they're not allowed to get this federal money. Really what they're doing is they're saying, we are not going to offer poor women and others in some of the most neglected countries in the world, we're not going to offer them any medical care whatsoever unless we're allowed to kill their unborn children. So what they're really doing is holding these poor women and others hostage in these other countries and saying, unless you give us money because we do abortions, we're going to allow these poor people to suffer from medical complications.
Let's talk about the legal challenges that are being mounted in the courts against the ban on partial birth abortion.
Oh, man, this has been one of the most intriguing trials that have been happening in the history of America. There are three trials going on right now. You may recall that even before President Bush signed the Partial Birth Abortion Act, there were lawsuits filed in three different states, in Nebraska, in San Francisco, and in New York. And within an hour after it being signed into law, at least one federal judge had filed a ban on the government enforcing it, and within a day, the two other judges had. So this week began the trial in all three of those cases. And there have been different kinds of testimony that's come out of the three cases. Now, one thing that your listeners may have been hearing about is the request for the medical records in the cases in which a partial birth abortion has been done. Now, the media has been reporting it as, oh, this is a privacy issue and the government wants these records from women, when really that is not what the issue is about. The abortionists themselves, when they filed for this injunction against the ban, claimed that it is medically necessary to commit partial birth abortions, and that there was an emergency. That's why these judges must immediately sign a temporary restraining order, because there may be a woman who faces a case of it being medically necessary to kill her unborn child in one of the most gruesome manners imaginable. What was on that basis, the judge signed the bans. Well, now the government has said, prove it. Prove that it's medically necessary. And the abortionists are saying, we don't really want to prove it. We want you to take our word for it. Well, in the case of Nebraska, interestingly enough, the abortionists handed over the medical records. They didn't even challenge it. They handed them over. But in San Francisco and in New York, they're claiming it an issue of privacy. But the government has said, we are not interested in the women's names. We're going to scrub, and you can even scrub before you give the records to us, the names, the Social Security numbers, any identifying information. All we want to know is, in these cases in which partial birth abortions have been committed, have they been medically necessary? The abortionists still don't want to hand over those scrubbed records. Now, in the case in New York, the judge has ordered them to be handed over. In San Francisco, the judge has said, oh, these records aren't relevant whatsoever. But in New York, the judge has ordered them handed over, but right now that's being argued on an appellate level. So what's happening in the courtrooms right now is the issue of fetal pain. The government has argued that the baby feels excruciating pain when the baby's pulled out of the mother's womb up to the point of the head being in the birth canal. Then the abortionist grabs a pair of scissors, stabs the baby in the back of the head, and then suctions the baby's brains out. The government has offered up medical witnesses who are experts in fetal pain, who have done studies to prove that, in fact, unborn babies not only feel pain, but they are more sensitive to pain than you and I are. Well, of course, the abortion industry doesn't want this offered up. In the case in New York, the judge has been very involved in the questioning of the abortionists. And just yesterday and today, he has been questioning the witnesses as to, how do you know if the baby feels pain? And the abortionist today answered, it's never crossed my mind whether or not the baby feels pain, either when there's a partial birth abortion or when the baby is dismembered. And the judge has just been nailing this abortionist in... does the abortionist describe to the woman before the abortion what he's going to do to that woman's baby? And the abortionist has been trying to dodge and weave and not answer the question, and has been saying, well, we tell the woman that the intracranial matter will be removed from the baby and or the fetus. And the judge says, do you use that terminology, or are you clear? And the abortionist says that, no, what we'll say is that the cranial collapses. Well, the judge actually said in the courtroom today, you make it sound nice and palatable. Do you say that so that they will not understand what this is all about? And the abortionist answered, I use medical terminology in order to describe the procedure. And the judge said, can they fully comprehend it, meaning the women? Are they not all Rhodes Scholars, are they? And the answer from the abortionist, well, that's true. And the judge said, it's so much nicer to say it in medical terminology, isn't it? And the abortionist said, yes. It's been very remarkable. Now, one thing that's quite interesting in this case in New York is that the abortionists keep claiming that the reason they need to do these partial birth abortions is because of medical anomalies. What they mean by that is the babies are handicapped, and that's why they have to kill the baby. Well, in New York, the judge that they are testifying before is blind.
Interesting.
So what, I just can't help but wonder what is going through the mind of this judge, that as these abortionists are saying that it's necessary to kill these babies because the babies are disabled, I wonder if he's thinking, this could have happened to me.
Wendy, 30 seconds for a final question. We've seen Born Alive legislation, ban on partial birth abortion, unborn victims we've talked about. Is the tide turning? 30 seconds.
Yes. And I say that because we're not only seeing these laws being passed, but we're seeing the culture be influenced by the debate over these laws. They're seeing the pictures from the ultrasound that this is, in fact, an unborn baby. This is a human being with arms and legs and brain waves. We're seeing the polling data show that people, in fact, understand this is a human being and this is murder. And now the next step that we're focused on is proving that, in fact, abortion hurts women in addition to the baby.
I did think of one more question. How would you describe the difference between the two presidential candidates going into this presidential election on this variety of issues we've discussed?
Well, we can look at it in a snapshot with the Unborn Victims of Violence Act. John Kerry voted against it, and President Bush signed it into law. There's a very clear distinction right there.
Wendy Wright, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues Etc. again.
Thank you. I'm glad to be on.
Wendy Wright, she is Senior Policy Director for Concerned Women for America. You can check out the website for Concerned Women for America at cwfa.org, cwfa.org, or you can call them at area code 202-488-7000. That's area code 202-488-7000. For the remainder of this hour, we're going to talk about the constitutional amendment passed by the Missouri House yesterday that would ban gay marriage. One of the co-sponsors of this bill, Representative Mark Wright of Springfield, is our guest. Representative Wright, welcome to Issues Etc.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity. I know Wendy Wright. There's no relationship there, but I've had an opportunity to meet her. She's a wonderful lady, so I'm glad to follow her.
Tell us about the bill that you co-sponsored in the House.
Yes, it's a bill that just simply defines marriage between one man and one woman in the state of Missouri. Now, in 2001, I was a part of a group of legislators that passed an amendment that defined marriage into the state statute on a bill that was passed by a Democrat House, Democrat Senate, and signed by a Democrat governor in 2001. And that was directly a response into what was going on in Hawaii. If you remember the debate in Hawaii at the time, they were talking about legalizing same-sex marriage, and Missouri legislators were concerned, so we passed it into our state law. And now we got the problem with Massachusetts and Vermont and California, you know, where the state law clearly says that same-sex marriage is wrong, and marriage is between one man and one woman, and we have judges out there who are just completely disregarding the state law, saying that the law is in violation of their constitution. So Missouri has decided to be a forefront on this issue. You know, if we do have other states that legalize same-sex marriage, Missouri doesn't want to be in the position where if these couples come to Missouri, we'll be required to accept those marriage certificates here in our state. And plus, you know, just last week here in Kirkwood, we had two same-sex couples that got married and submitted a petition or a license to one of the clerk's office there, and that was denied, and now they're going to sue. So this is going to become a legal issue in Missouri now. And we think the people of Missouri ought to have the opportunity to decide if our Constitution should say marriage is between one man and one woman, so we can kind of head off a lot of these problems at the pass.
Representative Wright, I've read a lot of legislation and bills and things like that. Usually the language is very complex and and legally, legislatively technical. The language of this is really very, very simple. Why the simple terms in this proposed amendment to the Constitution?
Well, I mean, it's a simple issue. I mean, you know, our state constitution, our state law, you know, the United States Constitution, the United States statute has always implied that marriage is between one man and one woman. I mean, that, you know, that's what marriage is. And yet we, you know, over the years, you know, the critics of this legislation yesterday said, well, you know, we're trying to restrict people's rights. No, we're not. We're trying to reaffirm what the rights that the founding fathers already put into our law and into our constitution. And so, I mean, it's a really very simple issue. You know, obviously the opponents of this are going to try to make it as complex as possible. But, you know, we already put limitations on marriage. You know, you have to be a certain age to get married in this state. You know, you can't marry blood relatives. You can't marry more than one person. You know, I mean, we already put restrictions on marriage. And to quantify it and say one man and one woman will only be legally recognized in the state of Missouri, I think is a prudent and responsible thing to do, because if you don't draw the line here, where does it go beyond?
What needs to happen next in order for this actually to become an amendment in the Missouri State Constitution?
Okay, well, we had the House Joint Resolution, which was perfected and printed yesterday. We'll have to third read and finally pass that. And then that joint resolution will go to the Senate, and they'll have to pass it as well. Now, the Senate has already passed a Senate joint resolution that actually had even simpler language than the House, if you can believe that. So more than likely, what we'll have to do is the Senate and the House will get together in a conference committee, reconcile the language, pass those conference committee reports, and then the joint resolution will go to the ballot, and the citizens of our state in November during the general election will get an opportunity to decide whether or not we should change our state constitution and define marriages between one man and one woman.
Amending a state constitution is not only lengthy, but it's rather weighty business. Is even given your enthusiasm and your sponsorship for this bill, are you hesitant to, or let me put it this way, what do you make of those who say, look, we shouldn't have to amend a constitution, a state or a federal constitution, every time we come up with a problem like this? Why is this necessary? How do you react?
Well, my reaction is, you know, yeah, it's really unfortunate that we're to the point where we have to change the state constitution and put something so simplistic into our state law. But really, we're at the mercy of the opponents of this legislation. I mean, they are driving this issue. You know, they're taking it to the courts. We're having activist judges in many states. And, you know, possibly in our own state one day, we could have an activist radical judge who says that the state law is in violation of our state constitution and therefore say same-sex marriage is legal. And that has already happened in other states. You know, it's possible that it could happen in Missouri. And really the problem we're looking at is what happens when if these other states do legalize same-sex marriage and these people move to Missouri, that's going to put our state in a very difficult situation. So if we address this, I think, in our state constitution, we don't have to worry about some renegade judge out there saying the state constitution doesn't address this and therefore it's legal. So I think every state in this union is put in a difficult situation. You know, the president has come out in support of a change to the United States Constitution, but that's going to be very difficult to do. And even many conservative Christian Republicans in the Congress are saying, no, we shouldn't deal with this with the United States Constitution. We should allow the states to address this issue through their state constitution. So I think we're basically forced to do this. It's something that's not a good position to be in, but it's where we are, and we have to do the right thing.
Representative Mark Wright, thank you very much for being our guest and taking the time to be with us on Issues Etc.
Thank you.
Representative Mark Wright of Springfield, a co-sponsor of the bill that would amend the Missouri State Constitution to ban gay marriage, defining marriage as a man and a woman. When we come back from this break, second hour of Issues Etc. is ahead, and we'll be talking with the author of our Issues Etc. book of the month for March. Got to squeeze in one more interview with him on the issue of Simon Peter, even though we're in the first day of April. That book is called Follow Me, Come Follow Me. Peter lays down his net. We'll be talking about Peter's reconciliation after his denial of Christ, the forgiveness that Jesus gives him after the resurrection. We'll be right back.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.